It's happening, readers. We have heard that you want paperbacks from our tailored book recommendation service called TBR. And I'm delighted to let you know that we're going to be in sync with your request. That's right. We're bringing paperbacks. Whether you hate carrying around bulky hardcovers, you're on a budget, you want a wider range of recommendations, or all of the above, now you can get a paperback subscription from TBR curated just for you by one of our bibliologists. Get all the details at mytbr.co. That's mytbr.co. We're bringing paperbacks.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. I'm Jeff Winkler.
And I'm Rebecca Shinsky.
Today we're talking about the Big Five uniting to countersue Iowa, the state of Iowa. Crazy Rich Asians coming to Broadway. Two authors on the Times list of the 100 most influential people. Some adaptation news. And I'm going to hit Rebecca with this at the start. And it's kind of a call for input as well. I guess I'll save my front list for a story a little. It's connected, but anyway, I was thinking yesterday about bookstores. I know this is out of nowhere.
Shocking.
But I had reason to hear about a place, I guess it's the Odeon in Florence, which is a movie theater, but you know what they do, and you know I
do
like
they
it.
Have
what
a bookstore?
They have a bookstore. They play movies by night and have like a fully fledged cafe slash bookstore by day.
Someone's doing it.
Yeah, the Italians. They've had 3,000 years to figure out culture, so they should be ahead of us, I guess, a little bit. Come on, we can copy this. And you and I are not bookstore tourists, which is kind of weird considering what we do. We're not like, I'm going to drop in a new city, and the first thing I'm going to do is find a bookstore. Though, if in the course of our perambulations or peregrinations around a city, we find one, we'll stop in there, right?
Yes. Right? I will pop in, but it's not a destination. Yeah.
Yeah, because here's the thing. There are a lot of books, but kind of bookstores kind of tend to carry the same ones. But I was like, okay, what bookstores would I go out of my way for to some degree? Just to go see. I think now, would I go to Florence only to see this store? No. But if I were in Florence, I would add it to my itinerary. I want to see what this looks like.
Okay.
But what are the top destination bookstores, historically, because they do something interesting or because they've been sort of influential? That got me thinking about iconic destination bookstores. Now, are you going to go there to actually go buy books? Probably your local Barnes & Noble has more books than these places do. They may have different collections, something like. But I'm thinking, so I call for input, podcast@bookriot.com. Off the dome, here's what I have. And tell me if I'm wrong or if I have any sense of this. And I'm going to do America because this is what I know. World ones, I'm open to.
Okay.
So in the U.S., destination bookstores that it's worth going to see, make a pilgrimage for, pay homage to because of what they are, what they represent, what their history is. So my local pals here downtown, I think that's one. The city, Powell's City of Books. Go see what it is. For
Powell's
a block,
is a destination.
A city blocks just to see what that is like. Powell's is one. I think the Strand in New York City is another one. This is a long-standing, you know, mecca of high literary culture. They've got, you know, they're famously snobby and unionized and, you know, just a lot going on there. And it's a vibe, too, the Strand. Especially go into the basement and search the remainders and review copies that people have sold surreptitiously, even though they're not supposed to. Real education. I learned more about the publishing industry in my first 45 minutes in Strand than I'd ever learned in my whole life before, just understanding what was going on there. So I've got the Strand in Powell's. After that, I think it gets kind of tough, honestly.
Yeah.
You know Chicago better than I do. Is there a signature Chicago bookstore?
Oh, it's a good question. I think there are some in the outer ring of the city and maybe in the suburbs. There are some indies that have popped up since I lived in Chicago, which it's been like 20, 25 years since then. So I don't know. When I lived in Chicago, it was a giant Borders on Michigan Avenue was the thing. Big four-story Borders. And then we would go north to a Barnes & Noble in Evanston. I'm sure there were little independent bookstores, but I was on a student's budget with an unlimited L pass. And so I was going where there were train stops nearby and that I knew about. I imagine that now, especially with good internet to inform you of them, which the internet was young when I was in college.
True. That's a great point.
I'm sure I missed out on some good ones. I know there's a, like a pretty popular, I think, women's focused or a romance focused bookstore in Chicago, but I don't know the name of it. And our friend,
Anyway, I'm a transition.
Yeah, Greg Zimmerman, friend of the show, who might be listening, works at an indie, but I think that indie is relatively
Roscoe
new. Yes, Roscoe Books
looks like
right.
a great little store, but I'm not sure it's pilgrimage worthy.
Yeah, and like I was just trying to think as you were talking about the Strand and Powell's of like what other indie bookstores do I even just know the names of because they're famous, but I couldn't tell you what they look like.
Next. Yeah, let's do that
like,
next.
Yeah, like Prairie Lights in Iowa City.
Yes, that was on my list too. The probably as trafficked by people with book deals on a per capita basis as any independent bookstore in the world.
In the last few years, Books Are Magic, owned by Emma Straub in Brooklyn.
I was going to say, that's one for sure. Yeah.
There's, what is the name? Parnassus, that Ann Patchett owns in
I didn't
Nashville.
Think of that. That's probably would... If we're going to do 10, I'm not keeping a list here, but we'll do this for another, but I'm soliciting, but we're going to do a first pass. People can hear what we're talking about.
And I looked when I was in Nashville a couple years ago, I thought about going to Parnassus, but I didn't have a car and Nashville doesn't have good public transit. And it was like a 20-minute drive from downtown to get to where Parnassus would have been in an Uber. And so I did not do that because that's a destination. Going to the suburbs for one thing is a destination trip. Skylight Books in... the Bay Area, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think a Bay Area is probably City Lights Books, the home of, you know, Howell and Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
Yes.
Like, that is a vibe, too. It does feel like a time machine there. Yeah, Skylight. I had on my list, Prairie Lights I had for sure. Book People in Texas, Austin, Texas. I think it's Austin, Texas, is a major bookstore.
Book
that's
People.
One I've been wanting to go to. I think also... Politics and Prose in Washington, D.C. is one of the signal bookstores in the country.
I feel bad that I didn't think about that. That's a great bookstore. Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, which is not...
Harvard Bookstore.
Yeah, not the university's bookstore, but near the university. For a while, they had really iconic merch that I think was getting them a lot of name recognition. I haven't seen it in a while, but that is a great bookstore. I did go there when we were in Boston and just, you know, happened to be in Cambridge.
You know, one in Chicago, I just remembered it's there. I've always wanted to go because it's interesting. It's the Seminary Co-op Bookstore. Which has its own history and unusual business model and practice. So that one, too. I'm thinking I don't even know if Blue Stockings exists anymore in New York City. I hope it does. But a feminist bookstore going back years. I don't know off the top of my head. There's a long history of LBTQ bookstores.
Yeah.
I don't know. For those of you who know this better than I do, I'd love to hear, like, if there's one or two Black-owned bookstores as well. I know some that exist, but there's one in Philadelphia, I know. There's been some that's been around for a while. I don't know the name off the top of my head.
Newish one in New Orleans that I think is Baldwin or named after something Baldwin related that I've seen that looks great. But I
feel like the original Ripped Bodice might make this list at this point.
Yes, that's right. The Ripped Bodice.
A dedicated romance bookstores.
Sure. And I know the Ripped Bodice, the Brooklyn location, hosts a lot of like romance podcast events. And like I've got some friends who are super into romance that have made trips up there just specifically to go to the Ripped Bodice and go to events. That's a good
Romans,
one.
Tattered Cover.
Oh, Romans, right. Tattered Cover
books.
Is like having some legal shenanigans.
Some issues going on. So we'll make this his own episode, but like I'm trying to crowdsource this a little bit. Like, what in your mind is the kind of person out there that's listening to a bookish podcast? What bookstores jump to mind as being iconic ones in the U.S.? And there's probably something we either don't know at all or are so obvious to us that we've forgotten it. I mean, even the original Barnes & Noble flagship in New York is worth going to see, I think. It's like kind of more of a rabbit warren than the old ones. I do like a bit of a rabbit warren. I think
it's a cozy feeling.
If you're going to go to a bookstore, it needs to feel different than every other bookstore somehow if you're really going to make a pilgrimage of a kind.
Yeah. When I was in... We're sticking to the U.S. right now. I was near one of the like really iconic global bookstores in Portugal last summer, but I didn't go because you have to get a ticket in advance and then stand in line outside, and it was hot.
That's a no for
and
me.
And I was jet lagged and I think we have a it's the Livraria Lello. It is beautiful. You've seen pictures of it on Instagram, I'm sure.
It's like a staircase
to the
with
show.
Red carpet.
That's
basically
it.
Is the centerpiece.
Yes, it's gorgeous, and they know that it's gorgeous. purchase. And like, if you get your ticket, then you can use the ticket as a voucher towards a purchase. But most of the books are in Portuguese, which I don't read. And that I was just like, you know what? I don't care enough about just seeing a beautiful bookstore when I have like limited time to wander around this city that I've never been to before. So I skipped on Livraria Lello. Some folks in my traveling group had been there or went the day before and, you know, said it was beautiful. They took good pictures. But that's one of those where like, truly, I'm not going in a bookstore on vacation unless I am going to be passing it anyway.
Yeah.
And then right. I will go in. Yeah.
Yeah. I made a out of our way trip when we were in London to go see the original Daunt books for kind of like research purposes. But it wasn't that. I mean, it wasn't a day of it. I was there for 30 minutes and something like that.
Now I'm getting, we're just going to do, you know, associative thinking for a little bit my brain remembers every independent bookstore I've heard of. But the King's English in Salt Lake City is a well-known one.
There's some book, I can't remember the name of it. There's one in New England. And maybe if I can't think of it, it maybe is telling me that it doesn't make the list of 10 eventually, but like the oldest bookstore in the U.S. is in some little town in Connecticut, I want to say. And again, I don't know if it's like pilgrimage worthy necessarily, but it's notable for that. And like, because I was thinking about, I was singing the praises of Elliott Bay Books on a recent show. And it's in a way, the platonic ideal of a bookstore, but almost by saying that means you don't need to go see it.
Because you just know what it is.
Because it kind of is like the, I mean, again, if you want to go to a bookstore, great. That's a great one to go to. But the archetypal chair is not a notable chair, notably, I think, is a way of thinking about that as well. Wonderful bookstore, great to hang out in. Big industrial space, got everything you want. But is it just so well honed? But is it notable? I don't know what the history is. I mean, there's things, again, I guess Shakespeare and Company in New York, they've moved from the original location. There's book culture in New York. Labyrinth Book, that used to be, I would have recommended that, up by Columbia, which is like a real, like, you could get academic books there that would blow your, St. Mark's Bookshop in New York is gone. So I'm not sure, but I think it would be a good list, like pilgrimage worthy, like almost historical.
I'd like to know from listeners who write in, like what are the criteria for a bookstore to be pilgrimage worthy to you?
Right. Yeah. It can't just be, I want to go buy a book.
Right.
Like that's kind of actually not the point.
What makes the bookstore special? Yeah.
That makes it special. Yeah. Okay. Let's do a sponsor break and come back.
It's happening, readers. We have heard that you want paperbacks from our tailored book recommendation service called TBR. And I am delighted to let you know that we're going to be in sync with your request. That's right. We're bringing paperbacks. Whether you hate carrying around bulky hardcovers, you're on a budget, you want a wider range of recommendations, or all of the above, now you can get a paperback subscription from TBR curated just for you by one of our bibliologists. Get all the details at mytbr.co. That's mytbr.co. We're bringing paperbacks.
As you are sending in your notes, ideas, names, glaring, embarrassing omissions for Rebecca and I, and thinking about iconic pilgrimage-worthy bookstores in the U.S., North America. If I don't have to cross a body of water, I'm interested. Or I can get over on a bridge. I don't have to fly to get there. You know, a shortish ferry will allow. You can also send in moms, dads, and grads recommendation requests. If you really have any reason to want to ask for a recommendation, could be for you, could be for one of the occasions, doesn't need to. This is just a grain of sand around which the pearl of our collective reading wisdom will form. It doesn't necessarily need to be this grain of sand. You can put another grain of sand in there.
Yeah.
And we've got a bunch in there, and I think we have enough. We're going to break this into two episodes, which actually
means
we probably
have a
little
more.
Yeah. We got a little more space. So we're not all chock a block full. We always have a wonderful time doing this. So send those in as well. Probably by this time next week. If you want to do it as soon as you hear this, both because we might be closing up the document and you can be closer to the front of the line so we can get to it eventually there.
Yeah. And if you are looking for like a gift to give mom or a mother-like figure for Mother's Day and you don't want to pick the book out yourself, let us remind you, the Book Riot has TBR, it's Tailored Book Recommendations, where real people, not algorithms, learn about what your loved ones love to read and what they don't love to read, and then send them recommendations or hardcovers or paperbacks in the mail. So there is an option for every budget, and the plans start at just $18. You can visit mytbr.co to subscribe or to purchase a gift today. It's historically, we've gotten great reviews of TBR, yes, especially as a Mother's Day gift. Moms like to be able to, you know, have some, it's a nice little service. Let me just tell you what I like, and then someone will pick out books for you. It's a good treat. My mom has received this on multiple occasions and she approves. So
yeah, it's especially a good last minute gift. The digital only, you can print it out, put an envelope, mm-hmm, with the flowers. You get a year's worth of recommendations.
It's,
you
great,
get to go in. You can have your mom or whoever you're buying it for, but we're talking about moms here specifically. They go in and fill out their profile, say what they want, what they don't want, and they'll get paragraphs back about, here are the books this quarter that we think you should read. You can get them from the library, whatever you want to do. So yeah, mytbr.co, there'll be a link in the show notes there as well. Can I tell you a frustrating bookstore story?
So yes.
I was, we were talking about Knife by Salman Rushdie, maybe, mm-hmm, being possibly, it's in the running early. I mean, I guess we're a quarter in for book event of the year.
Yes, definitely, you know, a right, big event.
So as I do with big book events, or what a big book event to me,
oh,
is
no,
I go
I
down to my
happen,
local Powell's.
Mm-hmm.
It's not on the floor yet, Rebecca. I go on Tuesday afternoon, it's not
that
on the floor.
That beautiful
yet,
striking, well, cover.
So I guess this could be on me, but I go in, Rowan's with me, my daughter. She's going, she trundles off to the kids and teens and comics to spend a few minutes by herself. We each get a few minutes to browse on our own. And I'm looking at the new release, the nonfiction new release. I'm looking, mm-hmm, at the new release. I'm looking at staff recs. It's nowhere to be found there. And I got so frustrated, I decided not to even ask. I didn't want to go ask them if they was in the back somewhere. I just left. I was silent. What are we doing here?
Valid.
What are we,
yeah,
doing here?
Were there, like, what time of day was this?
It was like 4 in the afternoon on a,
okay,
Tuesday.
Okay. Yeah. I don't have a lot of space for that either.
Usually, I don't understand it.
Yeah, usually bookstores, both indie and chain, on Monday evenings are stacking up their carts of all the new releases that are, you know, hard on sale dates for Tuesday. And either Monday after close, those go out, or Tuesday before opening, they, mm, go out, so that all the new releases are available. And I do remember from, you know, Barnes & Noble days that there would be like Tuesdays where things just got out of control and you might not get everything off your cart before opening. But something that's a big new release by 4 p.m. on Tuesday, if they have it in the store, I expect it to be visible. And this is, I think, one of the book events of the year. I probably would have done the same thing.
Maybe I'll go. I mean, I've got two books ahead of it I'm reading for work related reasons. It's not homework, but they're just what I'm reading next. So I can be patient. But, you know, I had a gift card. I was like, I've been saving it. I'm going to go buy it from Powell's. And it wasn't there. And again, I don't want to, whatever. Everyone has their reasons. I was just talking to my kids about this other day. Like,
people
assume
have reasons.
People have their reasons for doing the things. But the reason for this has to be pretty strange, I would say. I don't understand why this would be.
Yeah.
They make a couple of other, again, this is my local Powell's on Hawthorne here
don't
in
be
Portland.
Weird.
Don't be weird. I love this store. They do some weird stuff. And the one is that the prime real estate, you walk right in there. The next time you're in Portland, we're going to walk through. I'm going to take you through,
yeah,
my
let's
local
do
bookstore.
It. Okay.
I'm going to point to all the weird shit I've noticed about this particular Powell's.
Great. And well, it'll be like man reasons. On the street.
Yeah. Rebecca, what? WTF. Please help me explain. But
I
the
can't
prime
wait.
Real estate, you come in, right? Everybody knows. You walk in, there's a, you got a table of books. And what they've decided to do is put nonfiction front right when you walk in.
Okay.
And on the end cap, so like it's kind of like a dining room table shape. It's, mm-hmm, a rectangle. Mm-hmm. So on each side, they've got books set out. But the end cap that faces you, there's kind of room for four books. You know, uh-huh, it's
the short,
there's probably
side,
terms,
okay,
of art for this. The short side. And there's like a stack of five books with one on a little display with a cover up. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
There's four of them. And they're always picking really, I mean, they're big five and stuff. But like, ain't none of it going to be bestsellers, generally speaking. Mm. They use the most prime real estate for these sort of mid-list nonfiction picks. So I was in a couple weeks ago.
That's interesting.
And I wanted to flip through The Women by Kristen Hanna, right? I just, uh-huh, wanted to see it and like flip through a couple pages. And they had it, but it was the fiction new releases are to your right and sort of behind you, like there's these two bay windows. Huh. And the women was on the bottom shelf in the extreme left. And several copies have been sold. So you kind of had to crouch down again. I'm 6'4". Maybe your line of sight, you could see that
gold
leaf cover.
It's a long journey for you.
But it was like, that is not where I am. If I'm running a bookstore, I'm going to place what was and has been for the last several weeks the number one best-selling book in America.
Right.
Shouldn't I be putting that front and center? What am I doing? What am I missing about
this? I wonder, is this like, if we're going to do People Have Reasons, is it like how... when you just need to go to the grocery store to get milk, you have to walk through all of the other stuff first to get to the most wanted
I mean, that
thing.
Presumes, I thought about, that presumes that people are there to buy The Women by Kristen
Right.
Hannah, which is probably true. But I'm thinking, especially that book, that's well known enough that I think a lot of people are like, oh, there's a new Kristen Hannah book?
Yeah.
Would move a lot of copies that way.
Yeah, you'd want Kristen Hannah to be visible and... often, if people have like heard about a book on NPR or TV or a friend mentioned it, the bookseller is going to end up playing the game of like, it was on NPR. It's something about women. I think the cover is red. And I mean, I can't tell you how many times a day that happens to a bookseller, even with the internet. And making that cover, you know, kind of front and center of this most popular thing would decrease the number of interactions like that you'd have to have, because someone could walk in the door and see the thing and be like, oh, that's it. That's the thing I saw on TikTok or whatever. Yeah. It's really interesting. I wonder, you know, if they're just trying to like use that big prime real estate to try to move even a couple of units that might make a bigger difference for mid-list authors where Kristen Hannah doesn't like need any of their help.
Yeah.
But what the priority is it to like try to platform books that you think aren't getting enough attention elsewhere? Or is it to sell the thing that a customer who's walking in the door is most likely to be looking for just based on current sales patterns? Those are competing incentives, competing goals. I'd be really interested to hear about that.
Yeah, and I don't know. And again, maybe they had a problem with their shipment of Knife, for all I know.
Sure.
I mean, that's it always could be something like that. But the Women one really was striking. And I was thinking about it again, because I was thinking about Daunt Books and like the modern Barnes & Noble tactic. And I talked with this with Josh Cook about, you know, stack them high, watch them fly. Like that real estate is valuable. And do you put a checker on a checker to sell more of the things that are already going to sell for the name of the bottom line? Or do you decide
compromise
to do something different?
Yeah.
The highest and best use case depends on what highest means.
Right.
To you.
Yeah. What the values are.
The values are. And I thought that was pretty strange.
Really,
it's pretty strange to do it that way. So again, Piccadilly, I don't mean to pick on this particular store, but I've thought enough about books and reading. It's the one I'm in all the time. I'm just like, kind of odd.
I've had that experience a couple of times with my local Barnes & Noble when, like, usually I pre-order stuff that I really want to get, so I know that I'm going to have it on release day. But I think maybe it was when the Vaster Wilds came out. Mm. I just, like, for whatever reason, I had an e-galley, but we decided we were going to book club it, and so I decided to get a hardcover copy. And I swung into Barnes & Noble, and it was, like, too early in the day on that Tuesday, and I couldn't... It wasn't on... I cruised the new release tables. I was looking at the shelves. It wasn't anywhere. And then I happened to walk past a book cart that was waiting to be shelved, and they were all on there, and I just like grabbed one and went for it. But I was like, oh, sorry, bookseller, you're still working, but I'm gonna take that one. And I had the thought of like, oh, you know, like this, since the book is still being processed, it's probably in Barnes & Noble, stuff gets scanned, like the ISBNs are scanned and then coded for, like, it'll pop up and tell you where in the store that book is located. And that was probably coded to appear on some of their big new release tables, but it hadn't been put there yet. And I remember thinking, if I had gone to the info desk and asked them where The Vaster Wilds by Lauren Groff is, would they have even been able to get me to it? Or was this just the gift of serendipity that I saw it on this book cart because someone would have been like, oh, it's new, it should be on the new release table, but it's not there yet.
That's
like, we might have wound up at that cart together. It's a hard job being a bookseller and dealing with retail, and I didn't want to like get on them about like, this should be out. Lauren Groff's new book is a big deal, I think, by any measure of what a literary event is for a lot of readers. And I was just very surprised. And then I just went back to my pre-ordering thing of like, you know what, Barnes & Noble can just send it to my front door.
Speaking of pre-orders, we're right in the middle of Barnes & Noble spring pre-order sale where you can get a bunch of stuff 25% off. By the time this comes out, it's over. I think it's the 19th. But a couple of observations. It's Jeff notices stuff and I'm presented to you.
Welcome like to my podcasting.
Cat used to bring a half-dead bird to my porch and like, you know, to quote George Costanza, I laid the shit before you. So in the ongoing smorgasbord of barely interesting things I'm going to offer you, the next one is this. And I'm not going to use the worst word. Sprayed edges are everywhere. Paul Tremblay's new book is getting it. There's some I did see the Bardugo, the familiar in Powell's. Mm-hmm. And again, we talked about this. It's not stenciled. It's just black. Yeah. But there's a bunch of these coming. I was looking at some summer and fall. We're outside of it needs to be genre, science fiction, fantasy.
It's just everywhere.
It's going to be the new normal here before too long.
I know. And then it won't be special anymore.
And it won't be special. Star-bellied sneeched ourselves into this one.
Yep. I was catalogs earlier this week getting prepped for the new release draft for summer that we're going to do in a couple of weeks. Yeah. And I saw several books from a variety of genres, like you're saying, that had like sprayed edges or special foil covers. Like it's heavier in romantasy and fantasy, but it is appearing in other places too, and
it's dredging into other genres.
Jeff,
it's just that I don't want to tell
you.
There,
come on. I was trying to think about the first time I saw sprayed edges, and it's so rare in literary fiction. But it was like literary genre, maybe 10 years ago. I can't remember if it was like late Book Ladies Blog or early Book Riot days. But The Last Werewolf was a thing, and it had red sprayed edges. It was like
I remember
deep,
some
dark,
red ones.
Yeah,
I remember some red ones. Yeah,
it was like a blood red. It was very striking. But they were.
Go ahead.
They were not like marketing it to the internet girlies. It was just a cool thing.
R.F. Kuang is getting a re-release for The Poppy War, and a beautiful new edition. But let me tell you, there's some sprayed edges. That's another thing, the collector's edition coming out later. Uh-huh. Do you remember we had this idea 10 years ago? You and I were at a book industry study group session, and we were talking about why don't they make $50 editions of the new Toni Morrison book for nerds?
Yes, I do remember this. Mm-hmm.
And we came at it from the wrong angle. We were coming from upmarket literary sort of big
five. Right.
We didn't think about the collector. And this is another thing... this episode hasn't come out yet, though we recorded it, where I was talking about what I've noticed from social media.
Yeah.
But the utility of book as prop for book talk videos has offered unto us and the book buying and selling market writ large a new use case for the book as object, because an ebook on a reader just doesn't play as well
really
as
doesn't.
These other things.
The special editions, I think, are especially great for genre. I don't know if it's because the genre books tend to attract the diehard fans or folks like really get invested in these series. Yeah. But Brandon Sanderson has done this. Some of the some of the Kickstarted things have been, the $35 or whatever, like the mid-level gets you the hardcover, and then if you juice it up, you get like the big fancy edition. And I think it's really interesting to see it proliferate out of genre that like spreads. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna just give in. If you can't beat them, just say it.
The more you say, the semantic satiation will take over, and eventually it will not be so weird sounding.
But that as they are getting popular, I wonder if it'll like make its way all the way into literary fiction. Will we someday get like the $50 sprayed edge fancy edition of the new Ishiguro?
Well, it does tend to happen. I mean, we call them like the Library America edition or the 25th anniversary. Like it does eventually, or Folio Society does
that's
a really
true.
Beautiful
Folio
edition.
Does,
I think what's new is like for something that's de facto front list. I mean, I think that's the thing. Like who would be, I mean, if we ever get a stenciled edge Jesmyn Ward, I'd just walk into the sea, or like just have to like really come to terms with that's cool. And maybe it'll be fine, and maybe this is old man Shakespeare's
cloud.
But I think that would be the one I would be. But where would the beachhead be for something like that? It would be crossover. Maybe R.F. Kuang has another literary fiction novel I think coming out in the fall. That would be one where it'd be interesting to see if they did that, because she's got she's got a sizable genre following.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that would be one that would make sense. For sure. And with the genrefication of literary fiction, you could see one coming that, you know, what about a Keanu in the China Mieville?
Oh, yeah.
You know,
that would be
do
cool.
Something like that. I think I saw a picture of that. And I think mm-hmm. I might be misremembering this. I think it's, there was no dust jacket, but the actual cover.
The book itself.
Is like hot pink with like black images on it, mm-hmm. which feels like a Keanu China Mieville joint somehow.
It does feel right. Yeah.
So anyway, so much of that. But then a lot of talk about this strategically for Barnes & Noble. I'm back to the pre-orderness mm-hmm. of this all. That Barnes & Noble runs this deal. It's like 25% off to do a couple of things. One is for the kinds of people that care about physical books, reminding them that, mm-hmm. you know, making Barnes & Noble a part of their book buying habit, one. And two is, I believe, we got some feedback about Barnes & Noble behind the scenes stuff. And one of the things is the membership drive stuff is real.
Yeah.
I believe there is now a new free membership level ahead of this where you could get the discount mm-hmm. for the pre-orders.
But you got to give them your info.
You got to get your info. And we got a couple emails from frontline booksellers at Barnes & Noble of late or currently about what a cluster it is at the register for people to do their membership, because apparently they don't take phone numbers.
Oh.
Like it's only email addresses or something. Hmm. And the people, you know, you and I mean, how many aliases does the average sort of 40-something, 30-something, I mean, I've got at least 4 email addresses I use regularly for different kinds of
things. Yes, and it's a nightmare trying to remember like which one my REI membership is attached to.
Yes, right. Yeah, and because maybe it was that 6 years ago, and I kept that AOL account just for that. Michelle has a couple of different e-commerce ones she uses just to so that she keeps that stuff out of
Smart.
Her work email. I've got 3 different work emails because I've been here long enough that do things. I got podcast emails. I've got an old university. I mean, so who knows when I signed up for something. And so people stand there, especially during rushes, trying to remember what email address they get. And you've got to key them in, right? You can't scan a barcode.
Yeah.
Why can't we get a...
It was by phone number when I worked there. So they've changed something.
They want your email address. Yeah. That's what it is, Rebecca.
Yes,
they want your email.
Do.
That is the... I mean, again, sympathy for the machine. We know why they want this. We like email ourselves. It is the core part of our business. But when it comes to like the physical interaction of buying a book,
so annoying. That,
can you give me a QR code? Can you give me something to just scan?
Give me something like how Venmo has that QR code built into the Venmo app. That like Barnes & Noble has an app. They could do something like that, or you know that at Whole Foods you scan your little QR code and
you could scan your palm at Whole Foods. Let's forget about that.
Yeah,
speaking of Keanu Reeves, that's some crazy.
Is it your palm or is it like 3 kids in a trench coat reading?
Yeah,
the
I started unzipping my pants, put my butt on there, like sir.
No.
Too far. No, you don't need to do that. Oh, okay. So that I thought that was interesting, and in the books again. There is a self-selection. The kind of people mm-hmm. are going to email us about Barnes & Noble, it's probably not going to be people like, yeah, everything's fine. But I did want to pass along. But that particular I found, that's what we call a strategy tax, where mm-hmm. this one thing you want to do causes pain somewhere else.
Yeah.
And, you know, the people, those that work on high, that want the email addresses, aren't working the register on Mother's Day or, you know, Easter, the Saturday before Easter, we're all buying kids' books and grandma can't remember what her email address is.
It makes me disinclined to get a membership if I know that I have to say my email address out loud to you
when
I'm standing there. Because, like, I have a last name that you have to spell out, you know?
Yeah. I've got an apostrophe.
Yeah.
Who knows what happens?
But you don't have an apostrophe in your email address. Like, who knows? It's one thing, I think, if I'm buying stuff and it's like, do you want a paper receipt or an email receipt?
Yes.
And that person is already holding my credit card. So it's one thing if I'm like buying clothes and they ask me, do you want your receipt, like a paper receipt or an email receipt? And if they've got my credit card or they've already got something with my name on it, I will like tell them, or, you know, my last name is involved in my email account in some way. And so I can be like, you spell it the way it is on the credit card. That helps. But I just really don't want to mess with it. Like, you know, I also don't want to carry around paper membership cards for everything under the sun, but I think you've got to find some way to make it easy for customers mm-hmm. to sign up for the thing and to continue using it. And I feel like if I had paid for a Barnes & Noble membership and I went there often and then I had to like go through the shenanigan of spelling out my email address every time, I would be very annoyed and I would not renew it. Or I'm just doing all my shopping online. Like, whatever. Leave me alone. I'm not spelling this for you again.
Yeah, I don't love that. I don't love that either. And then to my last barely interesting thought was, I feel like over the last few years that the effort on authors' part specifically to get their fans to pre-order has ratcheted up.
Yeah.
And I understand why. I
mean, totally. You know, pre-orders matter.
The reason is, if you're new to this particular game, pre-orders matter for the following reasons. One is you can make the New York Times bestseller list right away because all of those, you front load a bunch of book buying.
Yes, they all count on day one.
They all count on day one. So you can make the New York Times bestseller list or some other list or whatever, and that's useful marketing. But the second thing is that publishers, some imprint, and this varies. So, you know, take it with a the world is complicated and not evenly distributed grain of salt. Use pre-order as signal for how much effort to put behind the book.
Yes.
In pre-publication, because they're getting pre-order information earlier, and then in subsequent weeks, author tours and advertising and publicity and all those kinds of things that go into it. I now wonder how much that signal is getting noised up by the hardcore people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if all the hardcore people are going to go buy a book of a specific author, and it's day one, there's, oh, look at all these sales, but then it falls off a cliff because all the hardcore people bought it already?
Yes.
I wonder how useful that, I mean, is there a world in which, I guess it goes back to the tragedy of the commons. Again, something you're going to hear me talk about in a different podcast later. There's a bit of like, if everyone is doing it, then the signal becomes less interesting because what they're looking for is like real signal about outsized excitement about this book that they, but if they're getting, if that's being manipulated or otherwise influenced by publicity campaigns, pre-order campaigns from authors or other interested parties, how does it get messy? So
yeah,
I don't know. That's just a theory of mine.
It's that data, I would guess, is really only useful as a measure of exactly what it is. How many people are interested enough in this book to pay for it in advance so they can get it on day one? And you can't know like what the driving motive of that interest is. Was it just because it was part of a 25% off Barnes and Noble sale?
Right. That's double, that's double confounding, right?
Yeah, right. Totally. But it lets them, it does let them have some measure of interest and demand, which is better than no measure. Or if it's an established author, sometimes the best measure is how did the last book perform? What trajectory, like what's the path that this author's passed several few books have done. It gives them something, but I do think there's a lot of noise in there, and I'm not sure that they can tease the these were pre-ordered, and I think, you know, what the sources were, like how many of them went to Barnes and Noble, how many of them went to indie bookstores. And so if you really wanted to, you could drill down on like, all right, well, this title was available for pre-order during a window where Barnes and Noble had a big sale. So like maybe we just discount the weight we give that a little bit, but look and see how it's performing at indies and how it's performing from other retailers and get a sense there. But I think I also wonder if it really makes that much of a difference anymore, because
it, that was like, my next question.
Every
is that one of those things that people say and now it's true, but maybe the publishing strategy has changed.
Right, like
maybe
if
like it actually doesn't matter as much anymore because
and what started. Percentage of readers are paying any kind of attention to messaging from the authors whose books they like? Like the book nerds, sure.
Yeah,
but this message.
Go ahead.
The message from like a mid-list debut author of like, please pre-order my book. Where are people going to know? Like, how are people going to have found this mid-list debut author? So it's a measure of like what kind of platform you've already got. But I don't know what else it's useful for at this point when everyone is doing it. It's kind of like the Spreadgest thing. Like if this is just the thing that happens, it becomes less special. If everybody's supposed to pre-order everything they like, then you just find out early that people like one book more than another one rather than finding out over the course of sales. But that, I think it does happen. We saw it. I mean, I remember it happening with The Testaments with Margaret Atwood. It was this big deal that there was going to be a follow-up to The Handmaid's Tale. And a lot of folks pre-ordered it and or bought it on day one because you want to find out what that's like. And then the reviews are middling and readers aren't super excited once they get their hands on it. And it just falls off a cliff. Like
those
the pre-orders didn't really tell you much of anything except that people were willing to pay for it early.
Yeah, it's just interesting to see the confluence of a couple of trends, and I wonder if suddenly you'll be the last one at the party. It kind of reminds me of, like, in the 90s how we were all rebels in exactly the same way. It's like everyone was like, everyone now is like, pre-orders and Spreadges and social media campaigns. And I do remember, and it's been a while since I got this number. Someone in publishing told me, you know, a couple hundred pre-orders for certain titles can mean a lot to us in terms of signal. Now, again, we might be talking mid-list novels. Maybe it was that. I can't imagine that 200 pre-orders for Sally Rooney's Intermezzo is really going to matter that much.
Yeah, you got to be pretty bummed if you're only seeing 200 pre-orders for a Sally Rooney book.
Yeah, but if you are, I don't know, if you're a Grey Wolf title or Soft Skull or something like that, maybe you are. But it also could be that your author just has a really good get out the vote campaign, and you're just moving those purchases up. So really, you're marketing into false signal. So podcasts at bookriot.com, all kinds of stuff. We haven't got to the agenda yet. This is all Jeff bringing stuff, and I'm not even done. I'm just getting going. We're gonna take another.
I know.
It's
like we did that whole intro with what we were gonna talk about, and that might have all been a lie.
Yep. All right. One more sponsor. More bookstore stuff. I talked, I don't remember when. I'm so out of order. We're doing out of sequence. Chris Ware Building Stories Podcasting. We're just recording in different orders.
There it is.
They're going to come out later.
A callback to an episode you'll hear next week.
That's amazing. Really good stuff from us. About the UK cover, UK editions being sold in this bookstore.
Tell me.
Apparently, U.S. bookstores can now order from Gardner's, which is a UK wholesaler.
Huh.
So if that's how these people got the book, that's not like someone brought in a duffel bag from spring break or something like that.
It's legit, is what you're saying.
It's at least came through that channel. That I do not have, thank you very much, Claire, one of our longtime contributors, sent an email in. Also, we were DMing back and forth a little bit. And she said that. And I said, okay, that makes sense in terms of the conduit, like how the actual physical books got there. But is that cool within the contracts about buying rights to a jurisdiction? And neither of us could figure that out. That still doesn't make any sense to me. How could Doubleday pay, I think I heard $500,000, it could be wrong, for James for North American rights? And they're like, oh, fine, Macmillan, you can bring your copy over.
Yeah, it's weird.
I don't get that. That makes zero sense to me. So again, I'm asking.
I don't understand it either. Yes, tell us. Yeah. Tell us things, folks. Podcast@bookriot.com.
You and I, after we talked about James in the episode that is lost to time, I'm going to do something for the Patreon that's going to use something. It'll come out soon. I don't know when. I think this is going to be tomorrow afternoon. I'm going to have two beers.
A little Friday afternoon.
In the sun.
Jeff and, editing like, party.
Right. It's going to be fun. But in that episode, no one heard and will only hear kind of like a lost, you know, a fragment of a Sappho poem. You're going to see like little bits and pieces of it. One thing we wondered about is Doubleday turning to Everett now, or Everett agreeing to a big five now.
Yeah.
And you and I were avoiding a bunch of James stuff until we talked. And I think as soon as we were done talking, we started Googling Everett interviews.
Yes.
And one thing we both learned, and I thought this was just fascinating to see while we're talking about that James edition, is that apparently Doubleday's been trying to sign Everett for two decades.
Yeah. Good call, Doubleday, for making that attempt. That was in the piece from The Millions, no, I think, that was, several attempts at understanding Percival Everett, something like that.
That's a good piece, I thought.
Yeah, that was a great piece. I was noticing on the Patreon yesterday, someone was like, please post the James episode because I want to know what, if anything, he changed from Huck Finn. My response to that is too much for us to summarize, even in that podcast episode. So like, if you're curious about what he changed, you should read James. You should just read James anyway, because it's great. But it is significant departures of degrees and kind and vibe and all sorts of stuff.
But also weirdly within the spirit of Huck Finn.
Like
It's at the same time. I think that's one of the
you can tell
multiple
it's
dualities of Everett's.
It's a signal text for him. I think he mentioned in that interview or in the piece that we were reading on The Millions that Everett has read Huck Finn at least 15 times. It's one of his favorite books. He really admires Twain. So it's not a take. It's not a taking apart of James or of Huck Finn. It's not a critique of Mark Twain's politics in the time of Mark Twain. It's a jumping off point that uses those characters and their story to do something, to do the things that Percival Everett does, which are make something completely new and different and challenging and interesting. And I would really encourage you to read it. But we also did not get into a taxonomy of what things did Percival Everett change from Huck Finn.
There's one big thing.
Yes. And we did spoil that.
But we gave you some, well, yeah. It doesn't matter what we said, but
right.
There's one signal thing, for sure. And then a lot of other tweets.
Yeah. I think you can Google your way to a spoilerific review. I'm sure those are on the internet.
Someone had, that's like, you know, maybe that's the kind of thing we would have, could have run, but I don't know if we've run something like that. I guess we're going to get out on this. We're not going to get to any of the news stories. Which we can I'll punt them to next week, whoever has to sit with me.
Sharifa will be here with you next week.
Yeah. When you're sardining in an Airstream with Bob. Top 10 bestsellers of Q1.
Mm.
Would you like to guess any of them? This is really hard.
I mean,
stuff. Everyone should know that this is extremely hard.
Yeah. Atomic Habits.
Yeah. Number 7.
The Women.
334,000 units.
Okay.
The Women, number 2, 469,000 units. I believe this is just print. This is just print. So
are there multiple Sarah J. Maas titles?
There are.
Okay, so ACOTAR and...
Yep, is 4.
Something else from the series that I don't know the titles of.
It's the newest one, House of Flame and Shadow, which is not part of that, I don't think. It's something else.
Okay, a new Sarah J.
76, that's the number one best-selling book of the year so far.
Okay.
Everyone at home, clap for...
thank you.
4 for 4. She's got 1, 2, and 7.
This is very validating.
1, 2, 4, and 7 so far.
1, 2, 4, and 7.
She's 4 for 4.
Are any more of them books that did not? Oh, I'm going to kick myself
for 2.
I'm going to kick my. Is it? It can't be Colleen Hoover at this point, can it?
No. This moment's Colleen Hoover.
This moment.
Come on.
And it's not Sarah J. Maas.
It's too obvious. I'm sorry. It's Fourth Wing and Iron Fist.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yes. I was going to kick myself. Those have left my brain. You said Spredges too many times, and I just like.
It's totally gone. Yeah. You memory hold it. I get it.
Okay. So that's 6 of them, right?
Yep. Yes. You don't have 3 or.
Oh.
8, 9, and 10 are all that are left.
Dov Pilkey. Isn't that one of them?
Yep. He's 3. Scarlet Shedder.
Great title.
Number 3, 404, 404,000 units.
All right. Of the ones that are left, were they all published this year?
I don't know. I don't think so. 8 and 10, I'm pretty sure, are TikTok books.
Oh, I'm probably...
And 9 could be 2. It could be orthagonal.
I'd probably
have no shot at any of these.
Boned
I wouldn't even come
there.
Close. You want me to do it? I don't want to
make you
flounder. Yeah,
because the only other TikTok thing I know that's happening right now is 1984, but I don't think that's actually selling. I think it's just kids being gross.
And it's the thing that's doing it is audio, even if it was picking up the Garfield thing. So number 8 is If Only I Had Told Her by Laura Nolan.
Yeah, I was never going to get there. Okay.
I don't even know what that's about. Mm-mm. I didn't even look it up. Number 9 is Taylor Swift, A Little Golden Book Biography.
Oh,
yeah.
Bless. Okay.
I don't know if the Swifties online. I mean, I'm sure. I don't know where that's coming from. And then 10th, I know, is it's one of the breakout success stories of TikTok is Icebreaker by Hannah Grace, which is a hockey romance.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Fascinating. And by like this time next month, The Places You'll Go will have replaced one of those on this list.
And I would say that for us, that is an extremely tough list.
Yeah.
Extremely tough.
Yeah, that's a tough, that is lots of TikTok, man.
Lots of TikTok.
You want to do quick front list foyer?
No, I don't. We're going to say that. You can do yours. But I was going to say that is a tease because I was looking at this for the next Patreon episode, which we're recording right after this comes out. Tuesday, Wednesday next week, is the spring Hot 50 check-in. And so I needed to look at some sales and some stuff. Got a pretty good turnover. So that's where I look at and try to determine what the Hot 50 books are.
It's not just sales.
It's not just all TikTok. I'm trying to mix in things that have buzz, hipster cred, adaptations. But there's some good turnover worth talking about. But
cool.
some of the books made it. I mean, if you are one of the... I didn't put all of these on here. Like, Atomic Habits is not one of the hot books.
Yeah.
But I got to look at... I have to look at If I Only Had Told Her. That's a book you and I haven't heard of. I've got to put it here. I've got to at least include some of these.
Got to consider,
You can listen to that patreon.com/bookriotpodcast. Why don't you do your front list?
Okay. I'll be out next week.
Yeah, you're going to be gone. And what's the point of even reading if you can't talk?
Right. Got it. It's not real unless you gram it.
That's right.
So, and I do want to shout this one out because it's a Book Riot contributor, Susie Dumond.
Oh, great.
Yeah. She had a romance novel out a year or so ago called Queerly Beloved. It's excellent. And her new one is coming out in June. It's called Looking for a Sign. It is super fun. It's about a woman who has just moved to New Orleans after the end of a 10-year relationship with her girlfriend. And she's like trying to just, you know, get set up in a new life. So she takes her best friend's advice and goes to see an astrologer. And the astrologer is like, maybe you were paired up with the person from the wrong sign before. You should get to know people from other signs and then figure out who you vibe with. And she's a little skeptical about like the whole scenario of astrology, but it's very much a like why not situation.
Yeah.
So she creates herself a dating challenge where she's going to go on one date with a person from each of the 12 signs of the zodiac. And she does it in the book with the help of a dating app that lets you filter by astrological sign.
Okay.
And it's just like, it's hilarious. It's steamy. It was just really fun. I read it over the weekend. I was like, this is really fun. Susie's a great writer. The like relationship stuff that happens in it is surprising and grounded. It had a twist that I didn't see coming. It was really great. So I've got to shout that out for Susie coming in the summer. Just a wonderful summer romance. And I am halfway through Knife by Salman Rushdie.
Oh.
Yeah.
What, if anything, do you want to say about it?
Yeah, dude. I mean, dude can write a sentence.
Yeah, Rushdie can write a sentence. Lest we forget.
Yeah, it's. I think he is just so really widely interested in not just literature, but all sorts of culture in a way that, like, I don't know much about him. And the book starts with like sort of his brain doing hopscotch about a bunch of like doing that sort of associative thinking about all kinds of things, but they're like all these literary references and movie references and music references. Like, this guy is just interested in the world, which is a thing that I really enjoy about people. So that was a cool discovery.
This is your first Rushdie, if I remember correctly?
No. I've read Rushdie, just not a ton of them.
I've
read some, but not a lot. And it is, I guess I shouldn't be surprised by it. I was telling Bob, I think that this says more about me than it does about Rushdie, but it's more sentimental than I was expecting it to be. Like, I have this mental model of him as this,
as like
a professor. intellectual,
bombastic and pugilistic.
Global. Global fighter for intellectual freedom and freedom of speech. And he does these really important things. And a lot of it is about in the early parts, you know, how he met his current wife and sort of the discovery of like late in life love that he thought his dating days were over. He met this person 5 years ago. I don't picture Salman Rushdie like holding hands with someone saying,
like,
you're my person.
Yeah, right.
And there's that moment. But of course, like, as I sat with, like, why am I so surprised by this? It's like, of course, he almost died.
Yes.
And he is recounting conversations that he and his wife had in the hospital while he is still very close to having almost died. And those are dramatic moments and they bring out our deepest emotions. And I'm really, I guess, delighted that Salman Rushdie is like putting all of that out there. But it was, it's so much, the writing is really gorgeous and very matter of fact about these kind of sentimental, emotional things. So it's a cool other side of him.
But it's not a switchblade cover of a read, it sounds like. There's a little bit of dissonance between like the switchblade cover and what you're getting so far.
Yes, and it roams back and forth. Like, it starts with the assault and then it pulls back to
Rushdie can't tell it straight. Like, I mean, that's what he does. He's not interested
non-linear,
in just going from A to B without recursions and digressions.
So it pulls back to like the night before the assault when he's standing out on the Chautauqua campus and he's looking at the moon and then he's thinking about like other songs that he knows about the moon and passages about the moon in literature and like how, you know, at this moment in time, he doesn't know what his life is going to look like 24 hours from now when he's barely hanging on to life. And he kind of does that same like weaving around wandering storytelling about the aftermath of things, refers to the assailant as the A, which is interesting. He's like, I'm not going to call him by his name. I didn't want to pick like assailant, attacker, whatever. So like, that's just an interesting choice.
That's really interesting. That's a Rushdian move. I remember one, I think it's in Satanic Verses. he has a character that if I remember right, I only remember the literary gimmick, not gimmick, but like move that I think this character was like kind of representing London, and his name was Elowen Dion, but it was spelled out like names. But if you sound it out, it's L-O-N-D-O-N. Like he does stuff. You got to be careful. You keep turning your toes.
Yeah. So it's real. It's interesting. I wonder, like, for it to be coming out now and the attack was in mid 2022, he would have had to start writing relatively quickly afterwards. Yeah. And my like human parts are just like, is this a little too soon to be trying to process all of this and put it into a book? I'm really glad to be reading it. I think it will come around to probably some of that sharper stuff. Like it's in there from page one of like, if someone makes you a symbol of hate, people will hate you. And this is, you know, his experience living under the fatwa and the reason that the person who attacked him attacked him. So he's coming at that pretty hard, but then that he backs off and is like, here's my love story, was just not something that I was expecting. So I'm excited for you to read it.
Because knowing Rushdie, and again, he does all kinds of things, so I don't want to try to predict, but it would not be unusual for Rushdie to do some of that stuff early to set you up for later. It could be, just because, I mean, I'm saying that for anyone that might be interested. I'm fascinated. I'm wondering about audio. I think he narrate it, but I don't know.
I have heard that he narrates the audio. I don't know what the thing is, but a friend of mine who's listening on audio texted and said, you made the right choice reading it in print. I don't want to tell you what happens on the audio, but like you made the right choice. So take that vagary for whatever you will.
Jeez. Okay.
They're like, I don't want to spoil it. And I was like, what could possibly spoil?
You're not going to spoil the thing. So you'll know it when you read it, I guess?
I guess. I'm going to finish. If I can't figure it out when I'm done with the book, I'm going to ask the friend.
It's like a 4-page long scream of just like capital A, like he's screaming with his eye bleeding out. Like, no,
I did almost get it on audio because I thought, you know, like Rushdie telling this story himself, that might be really powerful. So who knows? Like maybe try it and let me know. But I can return and solve this mystery for us next time I'm here.
I just finished today and we'll get you out of there. Cemetery of Untold Stories by Julia Alvarez. I really liked it. It takes a little bit to get going. There's like some bureaucratic reasons, but the main character inherits a plot of land in the Dominican Republic from her parents. That's kind of scrub land by the dump somewhere in a tough part of the island. And she decides to turn it into a cemetery for her. She's retired. She's at the end of her writing career. There's all these manuscripts that she's abandoned. She's not going to finish them. She had a friend who was haunted by a book that she couldn't finish. And she's like, I don't want to do that, but I can't finish them. So what do I do to get closure? I'm actually going to physically bury them in this plot. And she makes this, I thought it was going to be more of a metaphor, honestly, like her backyard, but she actually builds a cemetery with like a wrought iron gate. And I guess I'll spoil it up to me, kind of the inciting incident is the gates are done. The locals are interested in this big crew. They think it might be a resort for jobs. It's an economically, you know, struggling town. Like, could this be, you know, a resort, a casino, maybe even just a super rich person's estate? There'll be jobs for us. It's just turns into this wrought iron gate. People don't know what it is. And so one of the local women knocks on the door, or rings the buzzer, I guess is what it is. And the main character answers, and all she says is, tell me a story. And the woman's like, what? And she's like, to gain entrance, you need to tell me one of your stories.
Interesting.
And so this woman starts telling her a story to try and gain admittance. So it's like, it's actually more physical than I thought. And so it's kind of amazing.
Interesting.
In its own way. So that's what I'm reading.
Keep an eye out for that one.
I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm going to read next. I got some stuff. I'll talk about it later. That's our show. Podcast at bookriot.com. We want iconic bookstores. If you happen to be an expert in distribution rights for major big five publishers, I really want to get to the bottom of this. Is it cool for my local bookstore just to order up a UK or international cover edition and just sell it right alongside, or even in place of, I guess, more dramatically for a North American rights holder, these other kinds of books? Moms, dads, grads, recommendation requests. It's all the email podcast at bookriot.com. Patreon.com/bookriotpodcast. Rebecca, we'll talk to you later.
Thank you. Have a good one.